whether or not one likes Dershowitz, he is a man who has been involved in extraordinary events, has influenced extraordinary people, and has contributed to extraordinary historical happenings over the last 50 years of our nation.
When my bags are packed and I'm ready to go, it's time to be at the door. Looks like I'm moving on down the line. Well, I got my ticket and I got my hat. What's that going on? It'll come back. That's why I'm moving on down the line.
Hello. I'm Todd DeFeo, publisher and editor of Sightseer's Delight. Love him or hate him, it's hard to deny Alan Dershowitz's impact on law, politics, and society in general. A new book sheds a light on Dershowitz's story and his unlikely rise to prominence. I had the opportunity to speak with author Solomon Schmidt about his new book, Legal Gladiator, The Life of Alan Dershowitz. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Well, I think the topic is such an interesting one, and I think I haven't gotten very deep into the book, but you mentioned something to the effect of Alan Dershowitz being sort of the most iconic lawyer maybe in history. And so I really just wanted to hear directly from you, why did you decide to write this book and this biography?
I made that claim, and I did use the word arguably, because, we've had a lot of great attorneys, Thurgood Marshall, Clarence Darrow, F. Lee Bailey, Johnny Cochran, Robert Shapiro, who I did interview for this book too, in addition to Dershowitz. And I will warn you, Todd, I will name drop, because there's so many people to name drop when it comes to Dershowitz. And the amount of people I interviewed in this book is a testament to how important Dershowitz is to our nation. The reason I became fascinated with him, and the reason you can make a claim like arguably he's the most iconic lawyer, is, I mean, just the totality of his career is overwhelming. He has multiple careers that he's lived in 86 years. One is as a lawyer. He's done about 300 cases, including notorious ones like the Von Bulow case in the 80s, Jim and Tammy Faye Baker, the fraud case in the late 80s, early 90s, the O.J. Simpson trial, the Mike Tyson rape appeal, Jeffrey Epstein's plea deal, President Trump's first impeachment trial. That's just the tip of the iceberg. And those are just the notorious or well-known ones. Dershowitz has also devoted much of his life to working pro bono, free of charge, to help dissidents who live in oppressive governments be free from prison and have their life and freedoms back. I interviewed a few people who lived in the former Soviet Union and in Romania when Nicolae Ceausescu was a tyrant there in the 70s and 80s. And the testament of these people, I'll give you one example. Natan Sharansky was a Jewish human rights activist who lived in the Soviet Union. And in the late 1970s, he was accused of spying for the CIA, false charge. Obvious, of course, you know, that, as you can imagine, the KGB found a way to get him, locked him up, because he spoke out for human rights and because he was a Zionist. He wanted to move to Israel with his wife. And they put him in a labor camp for 6 years and solitary confinement for 4 years. And Dershowitz, never having known Sharansky or met him, worked, I don't know how many hours, thousands of hours over a decade, making speeches, writing briefs, lobbying politicians, appearing before Congress, sending out, trying to take out newspaper ads, writing letters, doing as much as he could to get this one man out of prison. And eventually Sharansky was freed, and I interviewed him for the book, and he gave some interesting anecdotes about his time in prison and his later relationship with Dershowitz. So, I mean, and that, the Sharansky case is just tipping the tip of the iceberg when it comes to Dershowitz's work for human rights. He's had a lifetime of it, helping in Ethiopia, I mentioned Romania and the Soviet Union, China. Ted Kennedy sent him to China in 1980 to investigate human rights abuses. So that's just his legal career. Dershowitz was a professor at Harvard, as you may know. He was tenured at 27 years old in 1967. and he taught for 50 years, 10,000 students approximately, including, name dropping again here, Ted Cruz, Jamie Raskin, Elliot Spitzer, Jeffrey Toobin, all of whom I interviewed for the book, and then Elena Kagan, Natalie Portman, and Mike Pompeo, so many others. He's also written, Dershowitz has also written about 60 books that have been translated into a dozen languages, 2 million books sold approximately. He's spoken in person to about 2 million people all around the world. And he's appeared, he's spoken in the House of Lords, in the French Parliament, in the Knesset, in the Sydney Opera House. And then on top of all these things, he's also very controversially been probably the most prominent Zionist on the world stage over the last 50 years. He's known or advised basically every prime minister from Golda Meir to Bibi Netanyahu. He's known Netanyahu since 1973. And he's taken on the greatest opponents of Israel on the world stage, Noam Chomsky being the most prominent example. I communicated by email with Dr. Chomsky for the book. He provided some interesting stories and behind the scenes to their debates, and he hates Dershowitz. So that was interesting to be able to give the perspective of people who don't like Dershowitz. So on top of all of these overwhelming historic statistics, Todd, Dershowitz has this intriguing human story. I mean, there's a real human story in the midst of all this fame and all these great accomplishments. There were a couple questions that drove me on in my research. One of them was, how does a man who started off life as a teenager, who from all intents and purposes didn't seem to have much of a future, he had horrible grades in school, he was terribly behaved, he faked his own suicide, he would mimic the sound of an air raid siren, knowing it would terrorize his one teacher who had escaped air raids in World War II. I mean, he admits he was a jerk as a young person. Mothers in his neighborhood would tell their daughters a variation of, "Don't have anything to do with Avi Dershowitz." That was his nickname, Avi, A-V-I. One of them said, "He's a boy with no future." How does that kid end up 60-odd years later on the floor of the Senate representing a president of the United States in an impeachment trial? And while he's giving this speech to the Senate and he's looking out at the leaders of our nation, some of the faces he's looking out at were people who had sat at his feet at Harvard Law School in decades past when they were kids coming into the law school. Mitt Romney, Ted Cruz. How does that happen? And then another very interesting question is, why does a man who until recently is a member of the Democratic Party his whole life, has basically only voted Democratic since John F. Kennedy, with one exception, he voted for his next door neighbor, Bill Weld, who was running for the governor of Massachusetts as a Republican. But even still, Todd, even though Dershowitz recently left the Democratic Party, he still holds classic Democratic positions, liberal positions, anti-death penalty, pro-exclusionary rule, pro-choice, pro-LGBT rights, pro-environment, pro-reasonable gun control, pro-separation of church and state, New Deal Democrat. I could go on. Why does that guy defend Donald Trump? And especially knowing that he's going to be canceled for it, as they say, knowing he's going to be ostracized for it, that his wife, children, closest friends, most of them, supporters, colleagues, all don't want him to do it. I mean, that to me, I mean, whether or not people like him, I think you could acknowledge that he, at least, even if you don't admire him, he's a fascinating man.
I think that the fascinating piece of it is the great thing to latch onto and a great point to build on, because my next question I was going to ask, and you might have touched on this a little bit, is what's the most surprising element you found as you started researching? And I think you might also ask a question of, everybody knows Alan Dershowitz. I've known of Alan Dershowitz for years. But almost why do you know him? Do you know him as a lawyer, as a professor, and you mentioned off all these different roles that he's had. And it is an interesting question of, why do people know him? I don't know if when you started researching, if there was a surprising element, or maybe what people most associate him with, whether it's a lawyer, professor, or author.
My guess is generally as a lawyer, Todd, Dershowitz came onto the national stage when he, against all odds, won the appeal of Klaus von Bülow, who was convicted of twice trying to murder his wife, Sonny. That is an incredibly fascinating case, a sad case, because Sonny went into a coma from which she never came out. The question remains, did Klaus do it? Did he try to kill his wife? Putting that aside, which is what Dershowitz has done his whole career, very controversially, he defends people no matter how awful they are, no matter how seemingly guilty they are, because he sees his role as defending a justice system where everyone gets a rigorous defense. People can disagree with that or not disagree with that, but that's what Dershowitz does. So he got von Bülow, his conviction, reversed. And the likelihood of him doing that was like so low. I think the statistic at the time was about 6% of criminal appeals were won during that time. And all the facts seemed to point to Klaus's guilt. And so against all odds, Dershowitz got him off, as they say. And the case was on the front page of the New York Times when von Bülow was convicted. So that launched Dershowitz into the national spotlight. And he had this sort of trademarkable look. He had this poofy red hair, big glasses, mustache. And you see in the 90s when he was added to OJ's dream team and when he worked as Bill Clinton's lawyer in his impeachment trial, when he represented Leona Helmsley, Jim Baker, Mike Tyson, Mia Farrow in the Woody Allen case, all these cartoons and parodies would appear. He was parodied on The Simpsons. He appeared on he was interviewed on many shows, Phil Donahue, Geraldo, Oprah, Larry King, all the major networks for the last 40, 50 years. Dershowitz has been on many, many, many times, all the way back to William Buckley, Firing Line. If any of your listeners remember or watched Firing Line in the 1970s, Dershowitz was on that show in 1976 arguing with William Buckley about the extensive free speech. Does it apply to pornographers? I mean, that was one of Dershowitz's more prominent cases early on, was representing a porn star named Harry Reams. And Dershowitz, I mean, he's not a flawless man when it comes to his personal life, but for a majority of his life, since he's met his wife, Carolyn, in 1982, ever since then, from all outside appearances, he's lived a pretty, very moral life. So it's interesting to see this man go out and go out to bat for his clients, some of whom seem to be really awful people. But again, the interesting thing is he does not see it as me excusing or defending terrible conduct. He sees it as representing a constitutional rule of law. And with the people I interviewed, Todd, people as different as President Trump and Jamie Raskin, Mike Pompeo and Noam Chomsky, Mike Huckabee and Elliot Spitzer, people on both sides of the aisle paid homage to Dershowitz as someone who has defended and maintained the idea of or the concept, the right in the Sixth Amendment to a rigorous legal defense, which was so important to our founding fathers. Oh my goodness, I've been reading a biography of John Adams by David McCullough, who was one of our great historians, and it was amazing to me to learn that so many of our founders were lawyers. I mean, I think I don't know the exact statistic, but I believe around half of the delegates at the Continental Congress, about half of them were lawyers. John Adams was a lawyer. He represented in the Boston Massacre case when British soldiers opened fire on American colonists and killed some of them. He represented the British soldiers, even though he sympathized with the ideology of the American colonists. He was asked about it. He knew he was going to lose career opportunities and respect, and he did it anyway. And he basically said, if we believe in the concept of equal justice for all people, the British soldiers have as much right to representation as the colonists do. And I mean, there was a quote which that reminds me of, which I put at the very beginning of the book, from John F. Kennedy in his book Profiles in Courage. He says, in whatever arena of life one may meet the challenge of courage, whatever may be the sacrifices he faces, if he follows his conscience, the loss of his friends, his fortune, his contentment, even the esteem of his fellow men, each man must decide for himself the course he will follow. Now, I'm not canonizing Dershowitz. He has his flaws. He, like every human being, seems to have an ego. Every person who makes big life decisions, it seems, often has mixed motives for what they do. But to an extent, that quote is Dershowitz to a T. And he is, I see him in a direct line from our founders like John Adams.
I think that's a fascinating point. And you mentioned the idea of cancel culture. We live in a very, whatever you want to call it, I think we're a time where a lot of people have different opinions and we're not always open to at least having a conversation about our differences, talking through our differences. We can ultimately agree at the end of the day, but we can also talk about it. And I think there's a lot of people that, I'm thinking out loud here, maybe to some degree, have strong opinions of Alan Dershowitz as a person, as an attorney, as a professor, as an author, you know, again, pick whatever title we apply to him. What would you say to somebody who maybe thinks, I don't want to read a book about him, I don't like him as a person? Maybe it's because he represented Donald Trump. Maybe it's because he represented Bill Clinton or any other of the number of folks that you've mentioned. What would you say to somebody who has that perspective and maybe isn't even open to exploring the legacy of Alan Dershowitz?
I would say that my book was not written with the goal of, let me convince people to like Alan Dershowitz. I know Dershowitz and I do like him as a person, which I tried to be careful to be neutral in what I wrote, and I think I achieved that more or less by interviewing people who despise him and who vehemently disagree with him. And I gave them airtime in the book. I mean, one of the things Dershowitz mentioned after reading the book was that he was surprised at how much I quoted his critics. And he actually didn't read a single word of the book before it was published, even though we did a lot of interviews for it, Todd. So what I would say is I of course want everyone in the world to read the book I spent years working on. But the reason I would, if it were a book on a shelf, I would read it because it's a fascinating story. David McCullough, I mentioned earlier, our one of our great historians who passed away a couple years ago. He wrote so many historical books that are widely regarded and loved. And he said that history is a story of human beings like us who have hopes, fears, dreams, ambitions, faults, flaws, who get put in extraordinary times. And whether or not one likes Dershowitz, he is a man who has been involved in extraordinary events, has influenced extraordinary people, and has contributed to extraordinary historical happenings over the last 50 years of our nation. To learn the human story of that man is an incredibly fascinating ride, I think. It was for me researching the book. And, you know, whether or not you like Dershowitz or any of these figures, through reading his life story, you come in contact with people as different as Elie Wiesel and Elliot Spitzer, John Kerry and O.J. Simpson, Stephen Breyer and Larry David, Bill Clinton, Ted Kennedy, Antonin Scalia, Julian Assange, Barack Obama, Donald Trump, Bibi Netanyahu. So he's just an intriguing human being. And I think one of the things I tried to do with the book was the book leads up to what is probably the most important moment of Dershowitz's life, which is him giving that speech with the eyes of the nation on him in during President Trump's first impeachment trial. What an incredibly weighty moment. The Chief Justice of the United States is sitting behind him. I mentioned earlier that the senators, most of them, are sitting in front of him, including some of them whom he taught at Harvard Law School. His wife and son are sitting at the gallery watching him. The cameras are on. Attorneys for and against the president are at his side. The nation is watching him. And this is a man who has studied legal cases his entire life, who has influenced legal cases his entire life. And here he is, the oldest man to ever speak on the floor of the Senate in an impeachment trial. I mean, to get to the point in his story where that happens. It's a very fulfilling moment, whether you like him or not, to see this 81-year-old guy who started off as this basically loser from Brooklyn. I mean, wow, I find an endlessly interesting life.
I guess the other thing I'd say, it really, he is almost the true American success story. I feel like you could say he's somebody, as you pointed out, was never going to be successful, or that's what his early trajectory seemed. And yet here he is, as you've so eloquently stated. I mean, he has really had such a huge impact on politics, right? All the politicians you just mentioned who have studied under him, and really the direction of the country over the last, say, 50 years or so. I guess, you shared a couple stories that I feel like that maybe were a little bit surprising as you started getting into it, but is there one truly surprising element as you started researching that you just did not expect to find in all your research?
One of the things that surprised me, Todd, was how transparent Dershowitz was. And again, I mentioned earlier that I like Dershowitz, so I'm trying not to come off as flattering to him, but this is just truthful reflections on my time with him. There was no topic of discussion that was out of bounds. We talked about Jeffrey Epstein. I asked him as many questions as I could think of about his relationship with Epstein. I put it all in the book. I put a picture of him and Epstein in the book. We talked about his first marriage, which ended horribly. I write about that in the book. And he gave me access, not to brag, but he gave me access to his personal archives at Brooklyn College, his alma mater, where there are hundreds of thousands of documents from his early years to later on in his career, documents related to his time at Harvard, his cases as a lawyer, legal memos, letters, calendars, diaries, pictures, interviews, newspaper clippings, and nothing was off limits to me. It wasn't like, oh, box 2319, you can't look through. I looked through highly confidential papers. I looked through emails between him and Prince Andrew in which they're discussing Jeffrey Epstein. And I, because it wasn't confidential, I published a series of letter exchanges between Prince Andrew and Dershowitz when they're talking about Epstein before Epstein was revealed as the pedophile he was. So That was something that surprised me. Nothing was out of bounds to discuss or look through. And with a guy who has known as many controversial people as he has, with a guy who has litigated all of these thorny, tangled, hotbed cases, I mean, the most hotbed cases. It doesn't get more controversial than Jeffrey Epstein, O.J. Simpson, and Donald Trump. And Dershowitz knew all three of those men and has represented them on some level. So, no, again, nothing was out of bounds. And just as a point of interest for your listeners, I did get to speak with the late O.J. Simpson before he passed. He gave some content in the book, and I spoke with President Trump, too. So your listeners might find that interesting. And there's a number of other interviews, too, that I think helped give a firsthand perspective in addition to Dershowitz's own perspective on his career.
I'd ask you what they all said, but maybe we should say buy the book to find out. Is that fair?
That's the horrible salesman thing to do. But hey, when you're an author, you kind of are a salesman at the same time.
I can empathize. I've written several railroad history books, so I can completely empathize the need to get eyeballs on your books.
That's right. And just a little shameless self-promotion, more than I've already done. I do have a website, solomonschmidt.com, and I'm working on another book about J.K. Rowling, the author of Harry Potter, which I'm knee-deep in right now. It's actually already available for pre-order. It's called A Pen to Change the World. So that's a very exciting project. And if you have any interest in J.K. Rowling or Harry Potter, I think you're really going to be interested to read her life story, because as far as I know, this biography is the first complete, fully up-to-date biography on her.
Well, let me know when it's out. We'll have to have you come back.
Thanks, Todd.
Absolutely. This has been fascinating. This is a great conversation. I really appreciate your time. I was thinking we'd go 10 or 15 minutes. We could probably talk for hours about Alan Dershowitz. I think he's that interesting.
Yes, he is. I appreciate you having me on, Todd. Thanks for giving me the floor and asking nice, thoughtful questions.
For Sightseer's Delight, I'm Todd DeFeo. Please visit sightseersdelight.com for more stories from the road.